Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the Almas Podcast. My name is Gabrielle Love. I am your host. I'm excited to introduce you to an incredible person today. I remember specifically looking at the sort of things that they have been up to and how long they've been up to those things and just thinking to myself, wow, this is absolutely incredible. I've got to talk to this person. I've got to introduce this person to all of you. So I'm very excited and I cannot wait to hear what they've got to share today. Without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Phoenix, aka Mohawk. Please take a moment to introduce yourself.
Yeah, so my name is Phoenix or Mohawk. A lot of people call me Mohawk, but you know, when you're trans, sometimes you have multiple names, so it doesn't really matter. Don't have a preference. Whatever people identify me most with, both are acceptable. But yeah, so basically, you know, I have been doing a lot of activism throughout my life. And, you know, as an adult, I would say like post my college years, stumbled into sort of a area of activism referred to as harm reduction. And that was just kind of through like my lived experiences and wondering like, you know, how could I use my skill set, my curiosity, my passions, and do something that's both beneficial for me and, you know, the people around me, the people in my community. So yeah, I mean, I'm just honestly like a really regular person. You know, I really enjoy like nerdy things. You know, my background, you know, my career background has been in like technology and, you know, things are like, completely unrelated to kind of how I got into this work, you know, but yeah, like it just became a big part of my lifestyle because it's just relevant for me. And I feel like a lot of people don't realize that, you know, that I wasn't like this this person who wanted to be like a social worker or something and all of that. It's just kind of like, yeah, I like the party, I like to do all these things, but you know, how do I approach this in a way that can make it less risky and spread that information to others.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. That's great. Thank you for that introduction. So one of the things that really stood out to me was that you founded something called PlurRx back in 2012. So we're in 2022 now, so you've obviously been doing this work for more than a decade. And you'd mentioned in your introduction there that it wasn't something that other people thought you'd get into or you thought you would get into. So let's start there because I'm very curious now. Tell us about your life before you got into the work that you're doing now.
Yeah, so, you know, like I said, I'm like really, really average. I'm like a very normal person. I liked playing sports and video games, and I made good grades in school for the most part. I was like a clown, you know, like a class clown. I liked to be really silly. Like, had a pretty standard, like, life, I guess, but I did have, you know, family who always valued things like community service, and you know, they were involved in church, and you know, they're like a Southern Black family if you kind of think of like the archetypical Southern Black family, you know, church going, having grown up during, you know, kind of the civil rights era. So like, you know, every year we're going to like the MLK Day marches and things like that. So like, you know, like kind of like politics and, you know, social topics, you know, those and racial topics were always kind of in my life growing up. You know, both from just kind of like my parents giving me like life lessons and also just, you know, experiencing things, having grown up in the South, moved to the Midwest for college, and then moved to New York City for work. So like I've, you know, been in three different regions of the US now, kind of experiencing life, you know, like I guess just kind of like, it was very different in every area how I had to navigate new spaces. So yeah, like I really had like quite an average life, but really how I came into this work, like I said, I like to party. I think everybody has something that they enjoy, whether that involves alcohol or other drugs, you know, kind of like even with that, you know, a lot of the work that I would do is just kind of like, hey, you're doing these activities. How can you make it safer for yourself? Because there's risk to everything. Like even for me as an athlete, you know, if you think of it in those terms, it's like, all right, you put on your helmet, right? Like if you're playing football or skating or whatever, you put on your helmet, maybe you put on some pads, you know, maybe you do MMA or something, you got your mouth guard, you're climbing, maybe you got, you know, a rope, someone spotting you, whatever. Like there's kind of like safety precautions you take, knowing that what you're doing is risky, but what you're doing is obviously enjoyable. At least I would hope it's enjoyable for you, or else, you know, I feel sorry for you if you have to like do a sport or something that you don't want to do, you know. So hopefully, you know, all of these activities are voluntary because you enjoy doing them. So for me, you know, I got into always loved dancing and stuff. Actually, you know, had gotten into breakdancing when I was in my teens, and so that kind of catapulted me into a lot of these party spaces before I was ever using any substances. So, you know, I'd be at like raves with like older folks who were breakdancers and stuff, or like b-boy jams or battles or whatever. So I'd be around a lot of people who were dancing, you know, there's music, and hey, maybe sometimes there are people smoking weed, drinking, or doing what they're doing because, you know, a lot of people were adults. Or a lot of people were young and getting into stuff. But I was not at the time. But, you know, I was in these kind of like nightlife spaces or these like, you know, higher energy social spaces. And yeah, like, you know, I was like into a lot of different activities growing up. And then when I was in college, that's really where substance use came into the picture because I was a rugby player. And a big part of playing rugby and probably a few other sports, but, you know, especially rugby is drinking. And I was not a drinker. I didn't enjoy any substances at the time. I had tried them, but it just didn't stick when I was younger. So, you know, at first I played rugby. You know, I'd show up to the socials after games or after practices and just would kind of hang out, but couldn't really relate to the people drinking and stuff. But it wasn't until I kind of found, like, you know, malt liquors and stuff like that that tastes really nice. That I was like, oh, okay, I see how, you know, after a few of these, the reason why people would want to keep doing this, like, makes kind of loose. It's kind of fun, you know. I didn't really kind of get to that overboard point yet, you know, so everything just kind of seemed like all fun and games and no harm being done. You know, I hadn't gotten to the point of, like, puking and things like that, you know, at some point that a lot of people will eventually hit when they get too comfortable with alcohol, and or weed, because, you know, that was around as well. I went to what was considered the number two party school in the nation at the time. Ohio University, for anyone out there listening.
Number two party school. That's quite metal.
And that was not why I chose it. You know, it just was, it just happened to be that. They actually had a really good school in visual communications. And like I said, I was going into a tech career. So I wanted to learn all the tools around like web development and software programming. And, you know, like at the time I was really interested in Flash animation, which, you know, we know to not really be a thing now, but I was super into animation and how to like do things with the internet. So, you know, I was going to school, doing my studies, playing sports, you know, but work hard, play hard kind of mentality. And then by the time I graduated and got into, you know, got a job and moved out to New York for that job, the nightlife scene here was unlike anything I had ever experienced. Like, I went to all kinds of parties and festivals and, you know, lots of dive bars and you know, like basement party, you know, random house parties and things like that. But coming to a place where like there were was like lots of interesting nightlife that wasn't just some random person's house party or, you know, a once in a while kind of thing that might pop up. Like I had so many options here. And there used to be these lists that I would go on at the time, and you know, just to get a time frame. I'm sorry, there's a little bit of noise in the back. It's you know, encroaching on spring here, at least spring-like weather in New York City. So we got people on their four-wheelers going up and down the street. That's how they do it around here. So
that's what they do once spring comes. They get the four-wheelers.
As soon as the weather is anywhere above 40 degrees, they're out on their four wheelers or their, you know, their bikes doing tricks up and down the block. But to continue, so you know, to give a bit of a time frame, like at this point, you know, I'd entered college in 2005, graduated by 2009, and I immediately moved to New York City. So I was, you know, in New York City, summer of 2009, and there would be these lists. You can go online and find like free open bar, free this, free that, just like, you know, emails, websites, just so much to get into. And I didn't have a lot of money at the time. I had just moved to New York and that was a huge leap. You know, I had a okay job, you know, it was the second recession, you know, we had the one in the early 2000s and then we had the other one in the late 2000s and, you know, it wasn't, the economy wasn't great when I was moving to New York, so I had an okay job. So I was still looking to have a good time. So I'm on these lists, going to all these free open bars or, you know, low cost events, things like that. So I was getting into a lot of stuff. And at some point, I dance, love music, and all that kind of stuff. I would be at raves, you know, so electronic music was a big thing for me, as well as I love like kind of alternative music of like rock and goth and industrial and those types of things too. And I think it was a Halloween party or maybe around Halloween weekend. I had actually met a band, and not about to date myself here yet again, on MySpace. So on MySpace, Someone reached out to me and they said, oh, you look like one of our old drummers. And we just kind of like befriended each other, you know, through MySpace. And, they invited me out to a party. I want to say it was around Halloween, or at least, you know, in the fall. And when I went out to this event, it was, you know, kind of like this goth party thing. And all I really remember from that night was at some point I just, like, bumped into somebody who gave me MDMA. And they didn't, like, I mean, they like, you know, it's not like they just handed it to me, you know. They asked if I wanted to buy it, and I knew about it, but I had never really had any access to what, you know, something I knew for sure was, you know, actually MDMA. I'd been told that things are MDMA and just had no effect. Like maybe it was completely bonk pill, maybe, who knows. But I was like, sure, you know, like I'm having a good night. Like, why not? Seems fun. So I bought the pill, and after that, it just kind of like became, that was, that was kind of like the opening of the can of worms, I guess. The gateway, I guess. I wouldn't even call it a gateway. Honestly, like I was drinking constantly already, you know, smoking weed. I was doing other lightweight things here and there. I wouldn't call it lightweight, but I was doing other things already. I hadn't really gotten into things like psychedelics. I was only ever around, like, you know, Adderall, cocaine, alcohol, you know, a lot of those prescription drugs, because I went to school in Ohio. It was in the mid to late 2000s where you had, like, I think they were considering that the second or third wave of the opioid epidemic, when it was Oxycontin and those types of opioids, you know, pharmaceutical ones. And I was around all that stuff. Didn't really touch some of it, but, you know, I was well aware of drugs. But this was my first time kind of, like, actually experiencing these more, like, psychedelic party drugs that I'd heard about, even had done reports, you know, for school projects on. And I was like, yeah, I'll do some MDMA. That sounds great. And, you know, the rest is kind of history from there. And after kind of being exposed to that, ironically, I had been like, how can I get more of this ecstasy? You know, like, this was great. You know, really seemed to make the night so much better. Because I was a little bit in a bad mood that night. You know, I was like, how can I make this night better? Like, I was having some fun. But my friends wanted to leave early. And I was like, no, I want to stay. But if I stay, like, I'm feeling kind of like out of, like, I didn't feel connected. You know, I was just kind of like there. I didn't really know anyone. And since my friends were leaving, I was like, ah, well, I'm not leaving with them. So how do I, like, kind of get the courage to, like, socialize more? And the MDMA did it. Like, I was talking to everybody, and I was doing all kinds of things I won't speak about. But I had a great night and made lots of friends, people I still, you know to this day. And I was like, how can I get more of this? I didn't take any information from this person who had given me the pill. I didn't really know people who were, like, into that at the time. You know, like, my friends were just, there are people who like to go out to parties and drink and smoke weed, but they really hadn't been into those types of drugs. But it turns out that I went to Red Lobster one day on a date, and my server was the person who had sold me the pill. And it was funny because
Red Lobster,
right, which was like my favorite place, you know, because it was always one of my like, I guess, birthday traditions from, like, I don't know, I think maybe from like age 8 or so till about 15 was to just go to Red Lobster and order the same two things off the menu. I did that for, you know, several years. And so for me, going to Red Lobster was like, I don't know, like, I know it's not fancy or anything, it's not the best seafood ever, but it was just like an easy place to go and get, like, some cheap crab legs and cheap shrimp pasta and be very filled. And, you know, it was just funny that they...
And get your MDMA.
Yeah, find my MDMA dealer. So it was very funny because she recognized me as well. She was like, oh, wait. I think I know who you are. And we just kind of both looked at each other like, wait, yes. Remember, can't really say this out loud, but, like, let's link up later. And, yeah, just, you know, just kind of all went from there. And so from that, I got really introduced into the New York City rave scene where, like, you know, drugs everywhere all the time. I was doing this every weekend at this point, as soon as I found these spaces. And, of course, you know, it was kind of the same risk that, well, I won't say the same risk, but there was a time, you know, where a lot fewer people knew about harm reduction, and there were still adulterated pills, there were still things being sold that weren't what you thought it was. Now the risks are a lot greater with things like fentanyl kind of, like, infiltrating certain supplies, or just so many different random chemicals kind of popping up in the place of other ones, but people are a little bit more informed about it now. But back then, nobody, like, really questioned much about the pills. If someone handed you ecstasy, you just assumed it was MDMA or something close enough, and, you know, you just did it. And I had so many bad pills that, you know, either made me nauseous or just did nothing, you know, after I wasted $20 or something, or ones that, you know, were extremely psychedelic, and I'm just like, wow, this doesn't, I don't think this is MDMA, like, I'm tripping balls, you know. And, you know, just could have been all sorts of different things, different combinations, and wouldn't always make for the best nights. And when they were good pills, like, I'd have, like, 3. So, like, you know, I was, like, doing a lot of drugs pretty regularly. And, you know, so were some of my friends that, you know, started to meet through these spaces. And it was, you know, after you spend enough time around a bunch of people in spaces that are doing a lot of drugs, and at the time it was PCP in the rave scene, it was very common for people to be using PCP. You could walk through the door of a party and someone would be right there saying, I've got PCP, you know, like it was very out in the open and flagrant in a lot of spaces, because most of these parties were underground. Like, we weren't going to clubs. We weren't going to, you know, like legal venues. A lot of times it would be random, you know, warehouses, or occasionally it would be an actual venue, you know, like it was a ballroom or something. But a lot of those, I don't know, a lot of those spaces, I guess, probably didn't know what was going on, you know, like, so basically, yeah, like there'd be a lot of unconventional venues for these types of parties, you know, sometimes even like, what were they called? Like laser tag, like, you know, cause it's, no one's using those spaces in the middle of the night, and a person,
laser tag.
Yeah.
Did you say laser?
Yeah. Like laser.
How do you host the party at a laser tag?
I guess.
How do you do that?
So I guess in some of those spaces, a lot of those walls or things are like, those obstacles are like floating walls and stuff. So I guess maybe they just push things out of the way. I don't honestly know how they made that work.
But I think I'm just trying to think of the logistics of getting in. Is it just, you know, someone that works there lets you in at night?
I don't know how they would work it out. Maybe they just would convince the owners or something. It's like, oh yeah, we're just having a party, and wouldn't, you know, fully disclose. And they probably just give them, you know, have some security person open up the venue for them, and you know, everything else logistically, you know, sound equipment, all that was brought in by the crews, you know, hosting the party. I honestly don't know how they did that. There's a lot of those types of parties that happen. I've been to one in like a boxing studio. I don't know. I don't know how they find spaces, but I guess for them, it just sounds like more business. So like, yeah, whatever, you can throw a party here. Just don't break anything, you know? But there's like, you know, zero supervision. So there's people just doing whatever whatever the heck they want. But yeah, you know, I was like around all these people doing these drugs and this and that. And aside from my own, you know, kind of like roller coaster of experiences, there would be people who would overdose. You know, there are people who use things like heroin and stuff in these spaces, and sometimes still do. You know, it's not always an accident that people, you know, overdose. Like, some people are using drugs that have a high risk for overdosing on, especially when you consider all the variables of, like, maybe this person hasn't used in a while and they're using for the first time, you know, in a while, and things like that. So, but I would, you know, hear about things like that, and just kind of like have these experiences of like, why does this feel different every other time I do these pills? Like, I know they look different and they're fun to, you know, like, it kind of felt like a card collection or something, you know, you collect, because like, oh yeah, like I would trade with my friends, like, oh, I have like this pink star, I've had this one last weekend, but you've got, you know, this blue dolphin, like, that's new to me, like, dude, would you want to trade? And like, you know, like it was like a whole thing. But you know, I just assumed they were all the same in one way or another. But after a while, I started to realize, oh, there's definitely different ingredients in some of these, you know, it's not just the potency, but there's definitely some with different ingredients, and sometimes I don't like it at all. If it has any like noticeable effect. And when I started to like look around online, I would see one of the websites that I had stumbled across. It's now called drugsdata.org. They post everything that people send to them to test, and they're, you know, licensed by the DEA to do this. And so, you know, they're allowed to basically take actually illicit drugs and test them. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, using a unique code, you could see, you know, if you had sent in a sample, you could see what the results of what you sent in was. And for me, as a person who was primarily using MDMA at the time, they all had colors, shapes, designs, stuff that were pretty identifiable. So that meant if, like, oh yeah, I had this, like, you know, purple heart, and I look online and see that there's a purple heart that came somewhere from the Northeast, especially within, like, a pretty recent time frame. It's like, okay, maybe this is the same one, because usually wouldn't see a copycat so quick to happen. But yeah, like that was kind of like, you know, how I literally just kind of stumbled into this, because I was just out having a good time. Nobody was like, hey, join this thing or whatever. I was just kind of like, man, like, you know, some of these nights I'm not having a good time. And, you know, neither are some of the people around me. Like, why isn't anyone talking about this kind of stuff? And, you know, turns out that there are some people who address these types of topics, but it just didn't have a lot of publicity, I guess, or traction at the time. And a lot of that, I would say, is due to the way the laws keep changing over the years. And so it makes it more difficult for these types of services to exist, as well as, you know, a lot of times people are just doing it as a volunteer thing. You know, they're just trying to help. Mm-hmm. So at some point, you probably, you know, have to move on to things that can help you pay the bills. Or, you know, some people had kids and now they don't have time to be at parties, like testing drugs and giving out information and stuff. So, you know, like a lot of people have just had to move on. But for me, it kind of stuck around for quite a bit. You know, how I've been doing the work has evolved a lot over the years, but it's something that I don't want to have to give up, because I think it's just really important. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to go away even if I say that, all right, I'm done. You know, like, at the end of the day, I'm still concerned about, you know, the people around me, myself, you know, people in the communities, and it's, you know, just like how maybe some people are really concerned about the environment, you know, like that's the thing that occupies their mind the most, and they're super, maybe they're super on top of, like, sorting their recycling and, you know, like reducing their carbon emissions and things like that. Well, that's kind of like what harm reduction is for me, is making sure that, you know, people are given kind of like compassionate care, even though they use drugs, because everybody's using drugs for one reason or another. You know, like, we all should have our own bodily autonomy, just like we do with, mm-hmm. you know, no one gets to tell you can't go have a giant breast augmentation, like, regardless how risky it might be. Like, if you want, you know, the biggest breast on the planet, you can go do that as long as you got the money, you mm-hmm. know?
Yep.
It might make no sense. It might be highly dangerous, but hey, you can go do it. So why can't somebody enjoy drugs on the weekend? I mean, they can enjoy alcohol, they can enjoy some drugs, but why not their drugs of choice, which could be any number of things? Mm-hmm. And then the markets only get more dangerous when you ban the ones that, you know, are already kind of like in use. Now they're trying to make new stuff, or, you know, substitute things in that people don't necessarily want or don't know how to use safely. So it would just be easier if you could actually access the MDMA you want, or the pure heroin that you want, or the, you know, pure methamphetamine and whatever, just like, you know, during prohibition, alcohol prohibition, where if you got some really bad moonshine, maybe you die or go blind or something. You know, it's the same kind of thing that ends up happening with other drugs.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Wow, thank you. That was quite the journey you took us on. Like, that was a great journey. There's something in particular that I'm very curious about. But before we go there, I just want to say thank you for sharing that. And I agree with you. I think drugs, you know, in my opinion, partaking in drugs should be a personal choice. And ideally, you know, we minimize the harm that can happen when actually being involved in consuming drugs or being around it as well. I'd love for you to give the listeners a bit of a better understanding for those who maybe have no idea what harm reduction is, you know, because 10 years ago, I didn't know what that was. I know what it is now, but 10 years ago, I didn't. So, you know, someone might not actually know what that is. So if you could just give people an understanding of that. And you know, particularly what I'm curious about. So I know that harm, you know, there's a lot of resources out there and a lot of help out there in terms of harm reduction, either on site at events, parties, and things like that. And I'm wondering, what about support and resources around experiences that people are having? Because you mentioned examples of, you know, you'd have an MDMA pill and then one night it would be amazing. And then another night, you know, maybe you're puking or nauseous. So if people are having experiences that are not so pleasant and maybe confusing, like if you popped an MDMA pill and had this incredibly psychedelic experience, that would probably freak you out, especially if you're not expecting it. So what about the support around coping with these unexpected, you know, kind of shocking experiences that happen, or even like the physical reactions that people have, just the impact that that might have on someone's, you know, emotional well-being or state, either during that time or after? I just want to hear a bit about your take on the support around that.
Yeah, so I'll start with, you know, defining harm reduction. So really, harm reduction in this specific instance, you know, this harm reduction movement is about non-judgmental, you know, kind of like peer support for people who use drugs, you know, to be able to meet them where they're at in their drug use. You know, we're in no way trying to push them in the direction of recovery or any sort of like abstinence or anything like that, or change how they, you know, I guess, use drugs, other than like offer resources and information for being more safe in the activity that they're already choosing to do. So, you know, a lot of harm reduction classically looks like clean needles, you know, like needle exchange programs, making sure people have safer injection tools, things that are not going to spread disease or cause abscess or like, you know, other harms like that. Harm reduction could look safe, like snorting tools, you know, like some people will distribute like just personal snorting devices, because you can, you know, spread disease from sharing snorting tools, especially if you do a lot of snorting. It could look like some of the things I'll explain where you're saying like the support, where like, for example, in New York, we just had the supervised consumption facilities that opened up, where people are able to, in a sense, like, you know, people often use the bar, like a bar is a supervised consumption facility in like an extremely loose term. I honestly kind of disagree with that, because like if you get way too loaded in a bar, they're going to throw you out, but you're allowed to, right? Like, you know, like they don't want that liability there. But in an actual like supervised consumption facility in the context of harm reduction, yeah, if you OD there, that's kind of the whole point. Now someone can respond. You know, someone can make sure that you, you know, have someone who can maybe administer the drug for you, keep an eye on you, that kind of thing. So a lot of people who are using these substances might be using alone, or they're using with someone else who's also getting high. That person, you know, if both of them overdose or are too high to kind of respond appropriately in an emergency, then they can't. So, you know, there's mm-hmm. there's like those forms of harm reduction, and it really came out of, you know, people who use drugs, in particular, like in the kind of sex worker and queer communities, you know, like during the AIDS movement and all of that kind of stuff, like harm reduction really became a community-based movement to address the needs around these like specific issues that have to do with people who, in other words, have basically just been like completely discarded and did not care. They did not care if people were dying of AIDS. They, you know, they thought these people were diseased, like they were lepers or something. Like if they even touch you, breathe the same air as you, maybe they'll get AIDS. So, you know, you're dealing with people who want nothing to do with you. But a lot of these people may have been using drugs. They may have been doing sex work. And then there's also, you know, just a lot of people who are not in, you know, the queer or sex worker community that still are like considered like a street population where they're using drugs on the streets. Disease can be spread. You know, people overdose. There's other harms kind of in that way. So, you know, it kind of like really focuses on public health. When you think about it, it's really like a prevention care type of movement. And we're just trying to make sure that we can reduce these harms to people who are engaging in activities that come with a lot of risks as much as we can. You know, there's going to be levels. You know, if you've got someone who's living on the street and, you know, has a chaotic addiction or something, they're using their drugs chaotically, then they're probably not going to be as cautious, but they're still, you know, there's still some steps they can take, as well as, you know, steps that someone who's got a different relationship with their use could take as well. So, you know, for example, like one way that could reduce harm for someone like that is instead of injecting the drug, you can snort it or smoke it, depending on the type of drug. So those two forms of ingestion are actually safer than injecting. So those are like, you know, that's like an example there. And as far as like care for people who have, you know, maybe a traumatic experience or a jarring experience around drug use, like that type of harm reduction is honestly even less available, I would say. I would say in part because, you know, harm reduction traditionally focused so much on these like street populations that there's sort of like a new wave of harm reduction that also wants to include and address the people who are using drugs who may not necessarily be, you know, like homeless or in a transient living situation or something like that. We want to be able to address people who might be partying with drugs, using drugs for other, you know, just using other types of drugs that might offer different types of experiences. And like, you know, for me using something like MDMA, and then if, for example, it ends up being extremely psychedelic and I'm, you know, extremely uncomfortable, having a very difficult experience, there are some places, and like I said, it's like very uncommon in the grand scheme of, you know, harm reduction services that are offered, but there are spaces that are usually considered like, they're either called sanctuary or something of that nature. They're usually like, you know, like a space where you have, like, I don't want to call them therapists, you know, they're like people, but they're like people who can help you kind of like process in some cases, this like completely disorienting this experience. Or even if you're not having a bad experience, maybe you just like need time away from this big party that's happening. you know, there's like a space that's usually set up so that you can be very comfortable. Sometimes they might have something like coloring books, like something that just kind of like distracts you for a while. Or there might be like mats so you can lay down. Maybe you just need to lay down. Maybe you've been dancing too long or whatever. And then there's people who could, you know, just kind of sit and watch and, you know, maybe listen if you want to talk or, you know, sit there in silence if you don't want to talk and just kind of like be support for you. And those types of harm reduction spaces tend to pop up at larger like festivals that tend to be more focused on like transformative like experiences. A lot of that stuff I usually see around like the Burning Man community or ones that are kind of similar in nature, where there's specific genres of music or specific types of people, you know, like you're kind of like new age, you know, like hippie like folks tend to be they tend to invest a lot in having like those types of like harm reduction spaces for like psychedelic harm reduction spaces. They usually refer to them as, but in all honesty, like anyone can go there. Like even if you just drank too much and your head is spinning, like you could technically, like it's not a medical emergency. You don't need to go see a, you know, EMT or anything. But maybe you need to lay down for a while, you know. Sometimes it's just a matter of like, you don't even have to have used drugs. Sometimes it's a matter of like, I gotta get out of this environment and I wanna go lay down somewhere nice where there's like nice people around me and some tea or something. So, you know, those types of spaces exist. And there are also spaces that like, you could go, you could like process it after the experience has happened. Like there's a clinic here called, Center for Optimal Living where, you know, people can basically talk to therapists about, you know, like the integrating psychedelic experiences they've already had. Or, I mean, I don't want to assume that everyone's talking about a psychedelic experience. Like maybe people just had drug experiences in general, but, you know, typically when you're using, when you're talking about integration, it's usually around psychedelics. Like, wow, I had this experience. I don't know what to make of it. It was very confusing, or maybe there's something I'm missing. Could use a second opinion. They have people who do that type of harm reduction support at that center, as well as probably lots of spaces now that, you know, psychedelic medicine and psychedelic kind of like therapy is really, really kind of taking off, I want to say, because of a lot of changes in laws, a lot of attention being brought to its therapeutic and medicinal properties and all of that kind of stuff. But I would say that, you know, it tends to be, people tend to favor the psychedelics because of the fact that there's a lot of clinical data around it these days. But I avoid pigeonholing myself into that because I've had lots of experiences that had nothing to do with psychedelics that were great. And, you know, some of them are medicinal. Some of them are therapeutic. Some of them are just purely recreational or functional. Sometimes I just need a drug to get through life, you know. Some people have coffee every morning because if they don't, they don't make it through the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people forget that, you know, coffee and alcohol are both considered drugs, and coffee is the most addictive drug on the planet, most widely addictive, widely used on the planet. And that's just because most people drink coffee and, you know, just kind of treat, it's very normalized to drink caffeine, even though it actually, you know, has quite the impact on the body compared to some of the other drugs. But this is actually a really good segue because I'm curious to hear, one, how, you know, psychedelics came into the picture for you, and how does the sort of, you know, the entrance of psychedelics, how did that impact the harm reduction work? You know, how did it add to it maybe? I'm assuming it probably did add some layers of things to consider as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess all of it kind of happened at the same time for me, because MDMA is considered a psychedelic. And, mm-hmm. you know, since the majority of the spaces I was using these drugs were, you know, they were raves. Some of them were festivals, but like initially I didn't have money for festivals. I was going to $5-$10 raves. Sometimes they were free because it's not like there was a door. We would just like show up to under a bridge or in a forest, you know, illegally and party. So, you know, I was going wherever I could. And MDMA was, you know, MDMA is considered a psychedelic, so it's ketamine, at least, or they offer psychedelic experiences. Like, sometimes they don't fit into that classical psychedelic, like, classic psychedelic territory. If, like, LSD mushrooms, that kind of thing, like, tryptamines. But, yeah, like, it kind of, those spaces offered, well, won't say, like, offered, but those spaces contained a lot of different drug use. So, you know, when you consider that ketamine is a psychedelic, you know, or at least even loosely a psychedelic because it has some psychedelic properties, so is PCP. Because PCP is like the stronger cousin of ketamine. And that's what was being used before. Ketamine was like everywhere in the rave scene. There's a lot of 2CB, you know, there, which is also considered a psychedelic, and you know, people were using LSD and mushrooms and all of that. So when I got into harm reduction, all of that was already in the picture for me.
Gotcha.
It wasn't always such that I was thinking about, like, you know, the sort of like peer support side of it, where it's like, oh wow, people are spiraling on this drug, and maybe they need like almost like emotional support. Sometimes, like, I hadn't really gotten that deep into it, and it kind of isn't what I like to focus on, because that's like a whole other type of labor that I don't think I'm cut out for personally. But you know, it would happen. You know, it's like if it was like my friend or someone I'm in the vicinity of, I'm not gonna just let them sit there struggling. I'm gonna try to help. So you know, a lot of times, you know, in these spaces where psychedelics are being used, and I'm using, you know, and I'm doing like harm reduction type work, or am kind of responding in a manner that a harm reductionist would, like, there eventually sort of became, I guess, like a manual of sorts of like how to respond to this. But for the most part, I was just like acting on my instincts and just making sure that, you know, the person was as unharmed as possible, because most of the time they're physically not in danger, but it's psychologically something that's going on. You know, something is, sometimes they're, whatever they're experiencing is not actually happening. So, you know, that could be a lot. But I would say that, you know, when I got into doing a lot of this harm reduction work, the focus was more on being able to inform somebody on the drug that they were taking before they took it. So I wasn't really that concerned about people knowingly taking up like a 10 strip of acid, you know, like if, right. but that's also a thing too, you know, that's part of the harm reduction work, that yeah, some people will push their boundaries, and then, and sometimes maybe they're used to it. Sometimes, you know, there are cases where people have done these drugs before, and this happened to be the time that it went wrong. You know, something went awry, something was different. And a lot of times the set and setting that they call it, your mindset at that time and the setting, which we're always in these overstimulating, sometimes very chaotic, you know, social environments of like raves and festivals and stuff like that. Any number of variables that could change your experience entirely. But that's also why people do these drugs in these spaces, because it's way more interesting than sitting in your apartment or something and staring at your moldy wall, tripping, you know. It's like, oh wow, there's a light show over here, and there's like all these people, and we all hug, and, you know, like, I can roll around on the grass, and it feels amazing. So, like, you know, people like the stimuli usually, but sometimes I could also send them, you know, over the edge, into a headspace that's not so comfortable. And so, you know, like, that's kind of where I started in just, like, doing a lot of drug checking, which, you know, we have some tools that kind of allow us to have a sense of what's in the drug. Like I said, sometimes I had no clue if there was MDMA in what I was consuming, and that's usually what I was going for. There were times where I didn't care, as long as experientially it would be nice, but I didn't know. I didn't know enough about a lot of drugs to know which one of these would maybe feel nice. But, you know, now it's like, oh, I have tools and understanding that I can do some testing on these substances before they're ingested and at least have some sense of, like, is there any MDMA in here at all? Is this actually methamphetamine? Am I going to be up for the next 24 hours? You know, is this like a completely other drug? You know, is this LSD or is this something else? You know, so a lot of times that's kind of where my focus was. And since you had mentioned PlurRx in the beginning, that was actually like that very, very first thing before I even learned about drug checking and stuff that I could do was just me learning a lot about vitamins and being able to relay information to other people, because we were in these spaces a lot of times, especially when it was a festival, you've got multi-day events, you're camping on site a lot of times, and you're partying for 2, 3, 4 days straight. Most of the time, these people are like completely malnourished, and you know, their bodies are going through it. And I had a friend who's like one of my, you know, buddies at the time who I would go out to parties with a lot. Like, one of his roommates was an aspiring doctor. She's a doctor now, but at the time she was still in school and everything. And she'd just be like, hey, you probably have depleted all your nutrients. Like, here, have some of this food. It has some of this, or have these pills. And I was like, oh, wow, like, I actually kind of feel better, you know, from, like, actually putting something good into my body. So I started to look around and, like, do some research and found a lot of forums and things that kind of discussed the concept of preloading and postloading. And that was just, you know, basically taking a handful of, you know, specific vitamins before you did the drugs and then taking a handful of vitamins, like, some period after you come down on the drugs or off of the drugs. And that was, like, my first introduction into being like, okay, this is actually helping me get through these nights and weekends a lot easier. Like, I'm nowhere near as in bad shape, you know, especially, you know, with drinking and stuff like that. Like, you're dehydrated, you're depleting all kinds of nutrients. So that was, like, kind of my first thing before I started to learn more about, like, the different drug cocktails and, like, distinguishing, like, the effects and then understanding that you could test it. But, you know, when I first started out, I was kind of like, hey, like, just have a few vitamins and you'll probably feel a little bit better. You won't have so much of a crash. And I used to just carry around, like, bottles and baggies and all these pills for everybody.
Like
I was a drug dealer, except they were just supplements.
Vitamins.
Yeah. And so that's where it started. And then I started getting into the, you know, like more of the kind of like preventative, you know, like maybe you won't actually want to take this pill at all, you know, if you know the potential contents of it. And then some of the more like peer support psychedelic, you know, I guess some of the more like that part of the harm reduction stuff came a little later, and I learned how to do it. Like, I took some of the, like, I took the training from Zendo, who's the primary group who handles a lot of that stuff, at least in the U.S. And it just, yeah, like I said, it's not my thing. I really don't want to take care of people like that. You know, I want to just inform people. You know, I'm like really nerdy about this stuff. I want to give people lots of scientific information, and let them do what they want to do. But, you know, if they have a bad time. That's, you know, that's for someone else to handle. There have been people where I tested their drugs. I'm like, yeah, this is not, you know, this is not what you thought it was. And, you know, give them information about it. Like, there was someone who had what she thought was 2 grams, which is quite a bit of this particular drug. She thought she had 2 grams of MDMA. And it turns out that all of it was methamphetamine. And I was like, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, well, this is definitely meth. And she was just like, can I still take it? And I was like, well, I mean, I'm not here to tell you. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm just telling you what this is. And right. I'm just letting you know that methamphetamine is extremely potent. You know, like it's just very potent. Like if you think you can handle that, like that's your choice. Like, I'm not here to judge. I'm not here to say yes or no. But she was like, you know, can I like dip my finger in here? Cause that's a very common thing that people do with things like MDMA or even cocaine. Like, they'll like lick their, you know, lick the tip of their finger, dip it in, and then, you know, like taste the drugs in their tongue or something. Like, take small amounts of the drug at a time, doing that sometimes. And she's like, well, can I dip my finger in here? And I was like, you know, meth is very potent and it's active in 5 milligram amounts. Like, so the amount that you would get on your finger might actually be a lot. And you may not want to do that with this bag of meth. You know, right. It's like, that's really all I could say. It's just like, hey, like what you're used to doing with this other drug, probably a terrible idea for this, but like, if you want to do that, then hey, like that's your choice, but I'm not responsible for your behavior after you end up, you know, like maybe like way too tweaked out or something. There are people who have come back, you know, since, you know, a lot of these festivals span over days, they'll come back like days later, like, yeah, I took it anyway and I had a terrible time. I'm like, okay, well, I mean, I gave you the information. you didn't want to really believe me that it might be intense, but now you know. And, you know, but if I see somebody, you know, out there in the, like, I'll get somebody to help, but I don't want to be the person having to watch this person for hours, because that's what a lot of, they call it trip sitting usually. Mm-hmm. Like, when you're trip sitting, you're sitting there with this person the entire time sometimes. Because, and tripping is not short. That's why it's called tripping. So, like, if you got somebody who's, you know, on LSD, for example, which is at least a 12-hour experience, you could be sitting there with this person for a while. At some point, maybe they will feel a little more level and get up and go out on their own, but you can't really abandon them in the middle of that experience if they're struggling. So that can't be me.
It's someone else.
You know, unless like there's absolutely no one else available, but in those scenarios where there's actually harm reduction services set up, I'm usually not the sitter.
Gotcha.
I like to be the tester or the informer. You know, I'll do.
You're the educator.
Yeah, I'm the educator. I'll maybe do triage when necessary. Sometimes medics have questions, but that's it. Like, I don't want to be responsible for someone's well-being while they're on the drugs. So,
it's totally fair.
But yeah, like all of the drugs have been around me the entire time I've been in this. And that's kind of like really where, you know, and in fact, like, because there's so much attention around psychedelics right now and cannabis, but I would say as far as harm reduction goes, there's a lot more attention on, psychedelic related stuff, just because there's a lot more risk with psychedelics than people tend to talk about. Because people don't really want to acknowledge it. Having those challenging experiences can be quite common. Especially considering that the settings that people are doing psychedelics in often are ones like festivals and parties and whatnot. The last event that I worked in September, well, it wasn't technically the last event, but one of the last events I worked last September, someone decided to use LSD for the first time at this festival. And this person, I don't know how many hours people were looking for them. They just kind of disappeared, and their friends were worried. And I don't know, like, they found them, and I think they were fine. But, like, this person just vanished. And, like, their friends were worried for several hours, had teams looking for them. And hopefully the person's experience was good, but, like, had everybody else worried. And that's what people do. Like, not everybody is going to use these psychedelics in some, you know, therapist's office. In fact, this, especially the people who are, they're growing them at home or doing whatever, like the people who want access to them without a medical model, which I totally support, you know, those people aren't just going to sit there and do psychedelics for their mental health. Some people are totally trying to party because it can be fun, yep. But also there can be consequences. You know, I haven't touched LSD in over 10 years because I had the most traumatic experience of my life on it. And almost died. So I was like, you know what? Like, I think I should chill on that one. I have lots of other drugs that I enjoy, you know, I don't have to go there with this particular one. So, you know, I like to focus in a little bit more on all the other drugs that are getting a lot less, I won't say less attention. Like, they're definitely getting attention, but I would say they're getting, like, negative attention. Like, people are really grasping to this medical view of, you know, plant medicines or just these natural medicines that they're, you know, lumping psychedelics, or some psychedelics, and cannabis and things like that into. And especially with this opioid, you know, another opioid crisis, people are like, oh, but you can cure people of addictions with psychedelics. I'm like, well, maybe some people actually just want to use opioids. You know, you don't, there are people who use opioids for reasons. It's not that everyone's, you know, got some sort of mental illness and this is a terrible disease. Like, maybe some people are actually, like, chronically in pain and they don't have access to anything else. And so they use whatever opioids they can get, which unfortunately is from very unsafe supplies right now, because there's no regulation that allows someone to get heroin for, you know, that's not cut with fentanyl or whatever else, which it's actually, like, cut with way more than fentanyl. Like, it's got Benadryl in it. I've seen some of it has methamphetamine in it. Some has cocaine in it. You know, some have quinine, which I think is malaria medication. Like, the stuff that's in heroin right now, like, some of them have, like, 5, 6, 7, 8 different things in it, including the fentanyl. And the fentanyl will most likely, you know, cause an overdose for a lot of people. But that's honestly not the only concern, because for people who might decide to go into, you know, recovery or something, they're not just withdrawing from an opioid. They've got, like, 5 other different things that they've been probably regularly, like, ingesting and having all sorts of weird reactions to, you know, withdrawal. Because I don't even know what the quinine's in there for. I don't know what that even does. It can't be psychoactive. I don't, you know, so it's like, why is that getting in there? You know, Benadryl, I assume, like, those things can potentiate the effects, but then you already got the fentanyl, so I have no clue what's going on. And, you know, I try to, like, focus my work where there's always the most need. So, you know, I would say that I feel like, okay, cool, people kind of got a handle on understanding a lot of drug checking stuff, or at least the basics of it. You know, people have a general understanding that psychedelics exist and you can use them for all these really cool things for your health if that's what you want. But, you know, and there's also, like, okay, great, there's all these harm reduction services that are catered to people who go to these festivals, go to these raves and stuff like that. But there's still lots of people who have none of this information. And so, you know, I've been trying to get more into communities that don't know as much about it because they can't afford these festivals. Like, I used to be a person who couldn't afford any festival, and even though at the time that I was attending festivals, you didn't really see harm reduction there yet. You know, like, for the people who are experiencing that now, like, there's harm reduction at lots of major festivals right now. And the people who never get to those spaces may never hear about the simple things of, like, testing your drugs or knowing that you can't just dip your finger in a baggie of meth and lick it and maybe be okay. You know, people are out here just doing all the risky things that I was doing a little over 10 years ago. Well, more than that, depending on the drug. But there's just a lot of people that I know that are in my circles, that are in my communities, that have very little access to this information. And, you know, I've started doing Narcan trainings, you know, making sure that people have access to Narcan, have access to the test kits, have access to, you know, all this educational information that a lot of times kind of gets pigeonholed and gatekept in these, like, more privileged spaces. And, you know, for the people who are very interested in psychedelics, for, you know, like, therapeutic or like, medical reasons or whatever, like, I know about that stuff too, but I also know about more than just psychedelics. You know, like, I could probably tell you what medical application just about every type of drug has. Or I won't say every type of drug. Obviously, there's way too many drugs for that. But I mean, like, lots of drugs. You know, there's a lot of advocates who, you know, like I said, things that get grouped into plant medicine, they usually only are talking about plant-based psychedelics and cannabis. But I'm like, well, you know, cocaine comes from a leaf, right? And heroin comes from a poppy plant. So, like, even if we're talking about coca and opium, both of which are things I've used, I'm like, so who gets to choose what's medicinal and what's not? Because in some cultures, both of these are. And considering that a lot of y'all are appropriating these cultures' practices anyway, why are you advocating that this one's fine but not this other one that also might come from a very similar region from where you got the psychedelic practices, you know? Like, I don't think it should be picking and choosing. I don't think it matters whether there's a medical application or not. Like, you could arguably say that cigarettes have zero, I mean, I wouldn't even say it's arguable. Like, cigarettes have zero health benefit, zero medicinal benefit. Nicotine by itself, yes. Nicotine does have some clinically proven health benefits. Cigarettes, though.
It does, really?
Yes.
Like what?
I forget the exact thing that I read about it, but nicotine, there was a study done where they observed that nicotine provided some sort of, like, neurocognitive protective properties or something, where I want to say it was like Parkinson's disease or something, where, like, it does something that it like created some sort of, like, protective properties that, like, actually would prevent a very specific disease from developing. And I forget what that is. I'd have to, like, try to dig that up sometime and refresh myself on it. But I was honestly looking up nicotine because it's considered a performance enhancing drug. And since I'm in since I do athletics and whatnot, I was like, how can I use nicotine, like, maybe in the gym? And you wouldn't want to smoke a cigarette. Because that's full of all kinds of other chemicals that are not great for you at all. And vaping is very dehydrating. So even using vaping, you know, which is nicotine salt, like, the act of vaping is, like, I get so dehydrated, like, my lips and nose are, like, dry and, you know, it feels like I sat in a sauna for 5 hours or something, you know. But I was looking it up and just kind of seeing, like, what kind of properties nicotine has as far as, like, performance, and had found that information. But I'm just saying, hey, we could smoke cigarettes to our heart's content. You know, we could smoke cigarettes till it kills us. And nobody is out here like, we can't use cigarettes, there's no medicinal benefits, because, like, it doesn't fucking matter at the end of the day, you know? Like, if you are above, in New York now it's 21, but maybe normal people in places still have it at 18. But if you're above a certain age, if you meet these requirements, and you're selling these cigarettes legally, you know, you can purchase them, you can sell that, like, you know, as long as the government gets its taxes from it, like, sell it. We don't care. You know, put the label on it that you might die, though. So that's, it's like, why can't we regulate everything else that way? You know, alcohol doesn't really have medicinal benefits either. Like, yeah, you can make tinctures out of it, so you really couldn't ban alcohol. But as far as, like, drinking, you know, like, alcohol, like, there's really not any health benefits to that, you know? And we can still drink to our heart's content. There's bars everywhere serving you, you know, alcohol legally. You know, you can go get it from basically every store that, you know, sells at least beer. You know, it could be a deli, a gas station, grocery store. It's readily available. You know, and people may argue that, oh, it can't kill you on the first time. It's like, well, that's not the reason why it's banned anyway. So that's irrelevant information. And most people aren't dying on the first use anyway, you know, unless it was a complete accident that they were taking it or had no idea how to take it, how to use it. But, you know, most of us know things about the substances we can buy, because there are PSAs, there are labels, there are, you know, movies, documentaries, shows, whatever, all these things that tell you about these drugs. So I just don't think it matters, you know, that there's a medical benefit or not. But I'm curious, you know, I'm a curious person, and I'll look and I'll see, like, has someone found therapeutic or medicinal use for these things, because maybe I want to use it in that way. I'm always looking for something that will help me kind of, you know, help me get through life, and not in like a, you know, I'm sad and coping kind of way, but just like, you know, like, hey, I'm almost 35 now, you know, just a couple of more months and I'm 35 and my body is very different. You know, my brain is also very different, you know, the world is very different. So I'm just trying to adapt. And, you know, it's just very interesting for me to just uncover this information and share this information, because for someone it could be really useful. You know, I find that GHB, because it is used for sleep regulation for people who have narcolepsy, it's like been the most significant substance for me to get very, very good quality sleep, which, you know, for me is very important. I find that using that for sleeping is kind of like medicinal, because it allows my body to recover properly. Some people use it to party because it has effects are similar to alcohol in ways, but you get none of the side effects, because GHB is a naturally occurring chemical in the body. Your body just kind of uses it. So, you know, some people find that to be very pleasurable for socializing, or, you know, for romantic things, intimate things. But at the end of the day, it's a sedative hypnotic. And because all these studies have been done on it for, you know, primarily narcolepsy, but I think some information is starting to, you know, be studied around, like, its use for insomnia. But, like, they have the data. The data's there. Like, you know, they've done all the sleep studies where they determined exactly what stage of sleep it impacts, how it helps the body regulate, you know, the circadian rhythms and like the benefits of that, that someone who's narcoleptic can like actually have a normal sleep pattern. So, you know, getting good sleep is extremely important for people's mental and physical health. So a lot of people will hate on GHB because it's stigmatized as a date rape drug, because people are like, oh, you could dose someone's drink with that. Like, yeah, you could dose someone's drink with LSD also. That's happened, you know, and maybe it won't make it unconscious, but it could put you in a very suggestive or vulnerable headspace if you're not completely freaking out. You know, if you're not expecting to be dosed with psychedelics, it could be an awful experience. You know, people assume that, oh, you can just dose them. You know, there's like jokes. They're like, oh, dose your family at Thanksgiving dinner, you know, like to try to resolve things. Idea. And like, no, like they're going to lose their minds. Do you know nothing about MKUltra? You know, you don't give people drugs unless they're kind of maybe prepared to understand the experience or in a setting that would be conducive for them being able to ride it out without, you know, complications. A lot of the studies that were done in, you know, the clinical studies that were done around psilocybin mushrooms, people were blindfolded with music playing. And then, you know, they'd gauge if someone's depression had like subsided, you know, for a period of time. They weren't frolicking through, you know, a forest or at a festival. They put a blindfold on these people and gave them relaxing music, you know. Probably not going to be the same type of experience if you dose someone unawares at a family gathering. But yeah, you know, I just really like to like hone in on all the various different types of substances that are, you know, very common, and just give people the kind of raw information about it, you know, because where we're at right now with drug policy and destigmatizing drug use is that people are feeling like they have to double down on the stuff that makes it look appealing to, you know, the general public or the government, you know, to try to get legitimize it by legalizing it or decriminalizing it and things like that. And I was like, no, like, I mean, yeah, maybe there's like some advantage to doing that, but at the end of the day, like, we still have cigarettes and alcohol. Like, I really think that if you take the right angle, you could, you know, like, at the end of the day, both those things are legal because I'm sure the government gets a pretty hefty cut of taxes. You know?
Right, yeah.
Like, just remind them that this will make you money. And they probably wouldn't care about anybody's health problems. They really wouldn't. I mean, it sounds horrible, but that's probably the truth. And, you know, these drugs are not, these laws are not in place to protect people who are, you know, to protect people from using those drugs. They do not care. You know, the laws are there in place to oppress specific groups of people. And keeping any of these drugs stigmatized means that they have reason to keep enforcing these laws that impact these groups, you know, various groups of people. It's often just the most marginalized groups of people, you know. And that's not helpful for anybody.
No, it's not. Yeah, that's definitely the history of the war on drugs, for sure.
Yeah, that's a whole...
Is at the root of the war on drugs, yeah.
Yeah, that's a whole thing. Yeah, that's together. A whole thing on its own.
Yeah. I'm curious. So, you know, you've obviously been doing this work for quite some time. You've learned quite a bit. You shared some things here, and I learned something new. I didn't know anything about nicotine's, properties as a performance enhancer. I didn't know about the other thing you mentioned. I had no idea about any of these things. So I think I've already learned a few new things, but I'm wondering, you know, for people that are either not too familiar with harm reduction or some of those people that you've mentioned, you know, that are still going to raves and sort of parties or smaller festivals where there isn't a high sort of price tag to enter or to participate, you know, and they maybe have no idea what harm reduction is, or just some safe ways of going about using drugs. Based on the experiences that you've had so far and everything that you've learned, what is it that you want people to know, you know, in terms of drugs and using drugs, and it just, you know, what do you hope people would be prepared with?
You know, honestly, I would just like to, like, it's less about the drug use itself so much, and just, we've all been indoctrinated in some degree to like look down on people who use drugs, or to stigmatize it in some way. You know, we've internalized those messages of don't do drugs, or, you know, crack is whack, or whatever, all these different things. And I see that that tends to permeate into these spaces too, where there are people who, you know, maybe some people would like use ketamine and then be judgmental of the people who are using cocaine or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there's also people who might not really use any drugs at all, who, you know, will obviously have some sort of stigma against people who are using any drugs. Like, I've seen people still think that you could just die from taking LSD, which is like, yeah, maybe if you like jump in front of a car, but like LSD is not really killing you. You know, so we've all like had these messages just drilled into our heads for our entire lives. You know, the war on drug predates, you know, the majority of us that I'm around in these spaces. So what I would really like to be able like to impart people with is just, you know, those new perspectives. Like, I'd like to be able to give people that information, you know, like you receive. Like, I like to tell people new things, and it makes them think about it differently. And when they can think about it differently and like stop associating like the most strung out addicted person that they've ever known with that drug, if I could like reframe how they look at the drug use, and instead of like, you know, maybe mistreating that person or ignoring that person when they need help, or just like not care, like caring less about them, I want them to just that to not be an issue. You know, when you're in these spaces and someone is, you know, maybe unwell in the corner or something or whatever, I just don't want people to feel like they can't get help, or that no one's going to help them because, oh, well, that person shouldn't have been using opioids, or, you know, that person shouldn't have used that cocaine, especially knowing that it could have been tainted, or any of those things. You know, it happens. And that's why, as I said, another reason why drug use becomes so dangerous, because if people feel like if people don't want anything to do with you just because of that, then they're not even going to, like, extend basic, you know, like, just like humanity towards you. They feel like you're not deserving of it because you chose to do this really dangerous thing, which for me is still just kind of like, well, some of you are actually choosing to do really dangerous things, and it's not fair for you to you know, be that way to them if they wouldn't even be that way to you. So really, I guess, like, the sense of community care, like, I want people to care about each other regardless of their drug use, whether they use drugs or don't use drugs, or used to use drugs, you know, or use some drugs, you know, however frequently, whatever. Like, if we're in these spaces and this person's not, you know, this person's not like assaulting somebody or something like way out of pocket, like, but this person just needs help, these friends, whatever, that people are going to treat them with care. And so that's really what I want to see, because part of the reason why I started doing this, like, yes, I was around all these people in these spaces doing drugs, but it was like nobody cared. Nobody cared if somebody is ODing in the corner. Like, they just leave them there. And, like, why was that? Like, nobody went to check on the person. Like, like they just kind of let them, you know, whatever, like didn't alert anybody. Like I would see things like that happening, or I'd hear things like that happening, and I'm like, that's not acceptable. Mm-hmm. Like, why would you just, like, I understand a lot of these parties might be illegal and things like that. You can't call 911, but someone should try something, you know, like anything.
Yeah.
You know, you get that kind of, when people feel like it's, you know, when they think that someone deserves it because they made a choice or aren't trying hard enough or whatever judgment they're passing, you just get people being very indifferent and flippant about human lives. And I don't, you know, that's just not how I operate. I just want to like impart this sort of like humanitarianism onto other people. You know, you don't have to like go above and beyond and like, you know, try to resuscitate everybody you see ever, but at least like, check the person's pulse, you know, ask if they need water. I don't know, just like do something. Don't just pretend that they're not there or judge them from afar or keep spouting these like very anti-drug messages that make people feel unsafe about even talking about if they've used drugs mm-hmm. or not. You know, a lot of times that could help if they felt safe to be able to have these conversations. You know, I've had people in my life disclose things to me because they didn't know who else they could talk to about it. Because if they said, hey, I've been using heroin, immediately other mm-hmm. people are going to judge or shut down or, you know, no longer speak to them or whatever. So it's just that I want people to be as safe as they can be, you know, especially when you're considering that in those nightlife spaces, people are just going there, you know, they're trying to blow off steam. You know, they're trying to have fun. A lot of times at these events, you've got people who are very marginalized. They might not even have a lot of money. So that's why they're going to these low cost events. But they, you know, they need community too.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. That was quite the answer. I was listening to that and I could definitely hear a lot of compassion there. That's super, super important. And a sense of safety that's definitely, it just has such a profound impact in giving people the room and space to share what's going on for them. Or, you know, maybe someone has a desire to explore something and all the stigma is just getting in the way and they're scared to try a new drug out maybe for the first time. You know, just being able to have these conversations and have spaces where people can feel safe to explore and just partake is super, super important. This has been an incredible conversation. I'm so grateful for the time that you took today to share so much, and it certainly was educational. I have one final question, and then I'll just leave you with room for anything that you might want to leave us with. My final question is, you know, for people that are out there, maybe they're partying a lot and starting to try drugs as part of their experiences, or maybe they're trying some new drugs, or they're just curious, or maybe they want to change things up a bit. Where can people go to find resources and support around harm reduction and even things like testing drugs? You know, I personally have no idea how you test drugs. I know that there are many many resources and harm reduction sites at festivals, and particularly the larger ones. But I've personally never tested a drug, so I don't even know what that entails. So just for people who are interested in getting more information, learning more, maybe just starting to explore a bit more about what they can do to reduce harm and you know, safely ingest drugs, or maybe for some people in their lives that are ingesting drugs, they just want to kind of learn on their behalf. Maybe you can give people some pointers on where to get started.
Yeah, so as far as information around drugs, I would say that honestly, like if you know the name of the drug that it is that you're interested in, or you know, have a general idea of maybe an experience you're looking for. I mean, Google, like, I don't want to just be like, Google it, but, like, you know, Google, like, if you Google it, honestly, like, when I started doing this, Googling it, like, you're not finding much. You were lucky to see a Wikipedia article about some of these drugs, or like, you mm-hmm. know, fleshed out. But when you Google it, I feel like there are a number of actually reliable resources. So, you know, a big one would be TripSit. It's really just, it's a giant wiki with, like, I don't know, I think it has like, might be like 500 drugs listed in there. I go to it often.
All right.
Because it's just straightforward. It's straightforward information. It's like methamphetamine, for example. Like, even if that's not a new drug, it's just kind of like, well, what's a normal dose for methamphetamine? Let me look it up on TripSit. I just type it in, and it'll tell me, you know, okay, you know, maybe 5 to 10 milligrams is light, and 10 to 20 is common, and whatever. And it'll tell you, like, maybe an oral dose versus, like, a snorted dose versus, you know, injected. Like, it gives you, like, all of the kind of, like, straightforward, like, okay, I'm trying to do this as responsibly as possible, knowing that, you know, I'm trying something new. Like, what is a dose? What's a good way to do it? What should I avoid mixing with it? Because a lot of people by default will just mix alcohol with everything, or even weed with everything, because they're used to just always having that in their system while they're partying, you know, like, but for a first experience, maybe you don't want to mix it. Maybe you want to just see how you do on the drug itself. Look up the dose, look up maybe some subjective effects. Like, for example, on Arrowhead's a common website that's been around for at least 20 years where people will, you know, try drugs and, like, document in very, like, extreme detail their experience on these drugs. So you could go on the Arrowhead and look up something like 4-ACO-DMT, for example. And then, this, you know, there are people who will be like, yeah, I took, you know, 5 milligrams, and then I waited, you know, and then 15 minutes later, I took another 10 milligrams, and then they give you this almost, like, diary breakdown of everything they did, their experiences, and stuff like that. And then you've got some websites like DanceSafe.org or Bunk Police. There's a few of them now where, like, the test kits can be ordered. And I would say that DanceSafe and Bunk Police are going to be your two go-tos. DanceSafe is a nonprofit that, you know, I did a lot of work with, and they've got more information, like more harm reduction information on their site. But I would say they've got the most kind of, like, thoughtful test kit program, you know, with very thorough instructions and, you know, just all the information you need to really understand how the kits work. Because, like I said, they kind of can really, like, give you an idea if you have this drug at all. You know, it doesn't tell you quantity. It doesn't tell you potency. Sometimes you can't always tell if it's mixed. Like, it's just, there's variables. So, like, you know, understanding how the test kits work, unless you're going to send it to Drugs Data, which is a lab actually testing it with, like, you know, equipment that pharmaceutical companies would use, or equipment that, like, forensics, you know, scientists would use to figure out, you know, in a criminal investigation if someone had, like, cocaine in their car or something. Like, that's as high end as it gets, and that costs quite a bit of money if you're doing a lot of drugs, and it takes at least up to 2 weeks to get that information back. So, you know, at home testing is your best bet. So, you know, Dance Saver, Bunk Police for those two are my recommendation. And then you can check Arrowhead for experiences, and TripSit for, like, you know, straightforward, like, the, you know, what is it? What does it do? What to avoid mixing with it? How much could you take? And route of administration, how long it lasts, those types of kind of like bullet points. And I think that's really kind of, I mean, there's lots of other sites that, you know, might have varying amounts of information that overlap or maybe are unique. But honestly, you know, like I said, if you Google, you're going to get a number of sites that are definitely reliable at this point. And then, you know, I've even seen like Healthline and Verywell, which are two like, you know, pretty good websites. I've seen them pop up in the most unlikely of ways sometimes. I think at one time I Googled, something about like anal injecting, like, you know, some people, what they do, what mm-hmm. they call booty bumping. So they will put the drugs up their butt.
Yep.
And yep. I was Googling something about that. And like, I think it was like the first or second result, Healthline was like, hey, this is how you can make a saline solution to put drugs up your butt. And I was like, well, that's interesting. I didn't expect Healthline to be giving me this information. Like, I was expecting to find like a, you know, harm reduction website or something. And funny enough is when I looked at the Healthline website, they actually like linked to one of the harm reduction organizations I work with and said that, you know, like Next Distro actually has a whole instruction manual for this. And I'm like, wow, so who writes for them? Like, I never thought that this would be the top article, the top hit on Google is like, you know, Healthline redirecting, you know, people to resources from this very small, only like 3 or 4 year old little harm reduction website. But yeah, so, you know, Google's fairly reliable, but I think there's some sources that are like, you know, go straight to them because you're going to find what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Fantastic. That was a ton of resources. That was way more than I expected. Thank you for that. Again, thank you so much for your time today. Do you have any final thoughts to leave the listeners with?
I would say, well, one of my slogans is, you know, like, test it before you ingest it, but that's no fun. But yeah, I mean, you know, like, just if for any reason, like, before this podcast you like felt kind of like icky about certain drug use or any kind of drug use, that I implore you to just take another look at it. To, you know, like, you don't have to use drugs. Just respect people who make different choices about their drug use. Mm-hmm. You know, and if they need help, then they're going to have to figure out how to get help on their own. Like, we can't save everybody. And that's, you know, as a harm reductionist, we're just here to, like, give them some resources. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. I'm not here to make anybody drink. I'm just, you know, leading them to the water. Let them hydrate. Let them make their own choices. So...
Amazing. Fantastic. That was great. Thank you so much, Mohawk, for your time today. I'm sure I definitely learned things, so I'm sure someone else out there, at least one person out there, listened to this episode and thought, wow, I had no idea. And of course, people now have lots of resources to check things out or just kind of explore new ideas. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Yeah, just wishing you all the best.
And thank you for having me on.